Welcome to G.L. Horton's Stage Page. Today is Sunday, the 4th of March, 2007. I don't know if you're able to get out to see any of the ICWP events G.L. helped schedule. There's still a few left. Actors will be reading monologues starting at 7 p.m. Thursday evening at the Boston Playwrights Theater, and there will be a writer's workshop at 10 a.m. next Saturday. In the here and now, we have three readings of our own, starting with Annabelle Gratt's reading of Economic Collapse, followed by Katie Curley's reading of the short play In the Livery of the Immortals, and closing with Perry Persoff's reading of Greg's Ghost Story from GL's one-act Cast the Spell. To start off, we have The Week in Boston. Will Stackman didn't make it today, so I'm going to try and make do without his insight. The touring company of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels will open at the Opera House the 6th through the 18th. The Stoneham Theater will be opening The Grapes of Wrath through the 18th. A musical, Heaven and Hell, The Fantastic Temptation of the Seven Deadly Sins, will be at the Boston Conservatory Theater from the 7th through the 11th. King of the Jews plays at the Boston Playwrights Theater through the 10th, as does More Than What at Center Stage and the Imaginary Beasts staging of The Comedy of Errors at the Charlestown Working Theater. The Vokes Players open Richard III in Wayland, while the New Rep opens White People in the Arsenal Center for the Arts, both on the 10th. My apologies if I missed anything. We hope Prof Will can get back next week. As always, you can find his reviews at On the Isle at profwill.spymac.com. Annabelle Gratt stopped by a few weeks ago to read the short play In the Dark with Gerilyn. While she was here, she also read a couple of GL's one-minute mouth-offs for us. The mouth-offs are short pieces GL puts together using material from news, blogs, or even overheard conversations. Like other monologues, they are free for use by students in class or by actors doing auditions. This one is about a worldwide economic collapse. Annabelle Gratt's.
Economic collapse might be the best thing that could happen to these United States. Maybe then Americans might start to act like real citizens instead of just consumers. Buying is America's everyday religion, and even religion on Sunday is selling it. People buy isms and dogma and rhetoric and candidates the same way they buy the latest shiny widget. And they never think to turn it over and check where it was manufactured or by whom. You can see our values made permanent in concrete and neon. Europe built cathedrals, drawing all eyes upward towards the glories of heaven. We build corporate cathedrals, branded monuments to the glories of consumption. Malls in the place of public parks and bandstands. Stadiums with skyboxes so the wealthy don't have to mingle with the schlumps. 10,000-member megachurches with exercise gyms and acres of parked SUVs. Priorities in this country aren't hard to see, but people are easily distracted. It may be that the bottom will have to drop out before Joe Average will open his eyes and look.
Well-traveled Katie Curley was wandering around British Columbia one day a few years back when she happened upon a couple of men fighting with swords. Actually, they were practicing a sword fight, but it looked real to Katie and her friend. One of the men explained, it's hard work making fight scenes look real while making sure they're also safe. The script she's about to read came out of an hour or more of conversation GL and I had with a Highlander staffer at breakfast in a small London hotel. It's pretty much accurate, if significantly condensed. Katie Curley reading In the Livery of the Immortals.
Uh-huh. You've spotted me. That's what I am. Ingrid. Handmaid to the immortals. No, it's okay. I love to talk to fans. Talking to fans is almost the best part of the job. The best part, of course, is actually talking with the main man. Or any of the immortals. Or the cool people they hang out with. No, really. If I didn't want fans to spot me and come up and talk, I wouldn't wear this immortals t-shirt. I call it their livery. You know what livery is, right? Yeah, it's like a uniform. But more exactly, it's the insignia worn by the retainers of a feudal lord. Indicates role and status. Not for lower servants like the scullery maids. for the ones who are on public display, from footmen up to the Lord Chamberlain. So this immortal shirt I call the livery of the demigods. You get it? Riffing on how religious garb is called God's livery. You know, the cassocks and the mitres and... what do you call those things that hang down? Right, the stoles. You're an English major, aren't you? Right, I can tell. Just like your friend here. Your husband. Right, I see the ring. He's a geek. The penguin on his Linux t-shirt is a bigger giveaway than your grammar. Your son's t-shirt wouldn't be livery, though. Most logos are just fan shirts, picked up at a con or a movie opening. Same as rock fans get their band shirt at concerts. Mild fans, semi-fans, who are really still mundanes. See me simply as someone who shares their interests, and they'll strike up a conversation on that basis. Yeah, like you just did. Dedicated fans. The ones who go to the conventions, make pilgrimage to the sites, like in the Middle Ages to the shrines of the saints. Yeah, those are fans. They approach me with awe and reverence. They recognize this particular t-shirt marks me as a member of the inner circle, trusted friend and gopher of the immortals. I don't know myself how or why. I wanted the job and I got it, but... I mean, I set out to get a job like this. Getting it was like my quest. So I researched where they were shooting and I hung around and made myself useful. But mega fans do that by the hundreds, so why choose me? Well, maybe it's because I'm so large. Everything about the immortals is larger than life, so maybe they needed to have big people serve them. They don't want to be always worrying about who's going to get crushed. They can relax. Believe me, growing up to be 6 foot tall by the time I was 12 is good training for living large. My brothers were even taller. We were like giants in the land of Lilliput. It wasn't hard for us to identify with comic book heroes. Of course, they can have superpowers. Compared to the shrimps in grade school, we had superpowers. And we had no trouble imagining powerful enemies. Because we were outcast freaks, of course. My brothers at least were welcome on the school teams, but who needs a giant female? I could dunk a basketball, but I didn't want to. Not against players who barely came up to my budding chest. I played games with my brothers. Football, wrestling, martial arts. We were our own alternative world. We read sword and sorcery books. We took lessons in hand-to-hand. Perfect preparation for wearing the livery, acting as a mediator. Fans have to physically look up to me, which makes perfect sense if people are going to see me as the earthly representative of a world that's bigger and brighter and more exciting than theirs. Just talking to me, or touching the hand that touched the hand of a mythic being, gives them a thrill. You've got to understand, the most important factor in heroic fantasy as entertainment is the star's right relation to their own legend. Why? Because the star is both the cult's object of worship and his own chief priest. But they can't totally buy into that or they go insane. They have to believe, yet not believe. So one of the things the inner circle does is reinforce the right relationship. Like, skill and discipline are so important, right? Fighters train and practice and rehearse. They're so very careful. Everything has to be just so, safety first. But equally, never let the caution get out of hand. Never go overboard. In the moment, when the cameras are running, or even when you're interacting with fans, you've got to look careless. Like sheer courage. Like it never even occurs to you that you could make a wrong move. Understand? The man and the weapon and the legend are one. Overboard? Overboard is ordering bananas off the set because somebody could slip on a peel and get hurt. Slip on a peel! Has anybody ever slipped on a banana peel? On stage or in the movies, right? Anywho, who do you suppose banned them from the set in Belgium? Right! Everybody went, duh! But we didn't say anything. We all just went along to the rap party. Meanwhile, I have my instructions, and I'm out ordering every banana in Brussels. At dinner, there are these huge, towering bowls of bananas, an all-banana yellow decor, individual bananas at every plate. Comes time for the toast, everybody stands and holds his banana up high, and ceremoniously strips it down and flings the peel on the floor. Talk about hilarity! Yeah, he's a terrific actor. The industry doesn't realize that because he plays a whole range of characters within the action genre, each so different as to be unrecognizable. So to the suits, he's not a brand name. Ergo, he's nobody. But the fans recognize him. They know. He has 8 different websites recording his whole career. When he was announced for the cast of the next movie, I helped to get the word out. The fans deluged the company, bombarded the suits with emails asking what his character was going to be and how much screen time he'd have. They know who he is and that he's quality talent. The suits better listen and give him what he deserves. Yeah, no talent celebrities can be a problem, but rock stars can fit in, add their own legends to the legend. A fan asked Daltrey if he or his character Fitzcarron had the most sexual conquests. He says, going by sheer numbers or by rate. Because Fitzcarron operated over centuries, Daltrey just decades. I guess it should be by rate, says the fan. But Daltrey still can't decide because he doesn't remember the 60s. Doesn't remember the 60s! Now that's the stuff of legend. But some of the rock star types the suits insisted on casting because they had European or Asian brand recognition, they're stars who can't act and they can't fight. You can fudge one or the other to some extent, but both? Acting? The shortfall is dealt with by dubbing. Stage actors are great mimics. They can do the star's voice, the one the rock fans expect, and get it to appear to come out of the image's mouth with real feeling. Just like doing an animated film, or like a toothpaste commercial. Fighting's harder, though. Stunt doubles and trick photography can only carry you so far. The fans can see through it. Even when they don't understand what it is they're seeing, they can sense that it's not right. They just do. Heroic fantasy has a through line, and to play it, you have to be a warrior. The adolescent macho preening and posturing rock stars get away with doesn't cut it. Well, right, it'll work sometimes for a quick and dirty cameo. A villain may survive for a while on gamesmanship, but up against real warriors in a fair fight, he's gonna lose. Dirty and quick. Where's the suspense? Fans demand better! Yeah, it's the fans who make my job easy. Right now I'm working on a production record for the Immortals' main website, stills of all the locations that appeared in the series. Everywhere I go, people come up to me and want to help. In Tokyo, they show me exactly where a scene was shot. They pull pictures and autographs out of their wallets as proof. Then they want their pictures taken with me to prove that. Talk about interactive! That's the next thing, of course, the video game. Those exotic locations will be digital backgrounds, and fans will be able to play out new adventures of their own. That excited them in the series. The Immortals have to be very careful about who they license, because the game will be a world where fans are supreme. Scenarios will breed scenarios. What the first fans choose most often will become the basic plot, and the available variations will be based on probability curves. The danger of this is that the vivid individual, the source of surprise and satisfaction, may be washed away. Yeah, well, it's sad. Mass imagination tends to become least common denominator. The hero with 1,000 faces? Finally, he has no face. He's nobody. A real hero is mythic and peculiar at the same time. A guy who has tremendous power but is vulnerable on little things. Adrian has the lucky coat, right? It's his coat, but it's also the character's coat. You've seen it, right? It's not just a costume, it's his talisman. He wore it to his original audition. He wears it in the scenes that everybody remembers. Because he figures out a way that he can wear it, he fits it into the story. On any climactic occasion where it really matters. Because Adrian's superstitious, the character is superstitious. Sure it is, it's an actor thing. Actors and athletes and gamblers and fighters, we're all superstitious. But immortals? Why should they be? Hey, immortals are only demigods, so why shouldn't they? Even the ancient Olympians had their objects of power. Caduceus, girdle, winged helmet, never left home without them. The only time I leave home without my livery is when I'm out with my family, when I want to be invisible. Or as close to invisible as a 6'13" stone woman ever gets.
Our next reader, Perry Prisoff, has a background in radio and sound production, with on-air stints locally at WXRV, The River, and WZLX. He also does voiceover work, being especially fond of character voices and dialects. Originally from California, Perry has lived in Boston since 1997, but he's been a Red Sox fan for longer, so feel free to send him tickets. Through me, of course. Perry wanted to read Greg's ghost story from the one-act play Cast Spell, and I wanted to see what he could do with it. Rather well, I thought. Here's Perry Prisoff.
About 3 years ago, I went up to New Hampshire to stay with this friend of mine, William Deems. When he picked me up at the bus station, Will looked kind of funny, like there was something wrong, but he didn't want to tell me. I thought maybe his girlfriend had showed up and he wanted to get rid of me. But when I asked him, Will just laughed and said he didn't know how to explain it, but there was something weird about his cabin. Weird is right, it was haunted. It had belonged to this little old lady, maybe 85. She lived out there all alone, doing the chores all herself, right up to the winter she died. After she died, seems she decided to stick around the place. Will would go out in the morning and come back to find a fire lit in the stove, or the lamp on if he got home after dark. After a while, Will just got used to it. Granny'd do up the dishes or leave out a cup of hot tea for him. He'd be reading or working while the old lady's rocker would be going gently back and forth, like she was sitting there knitting. But if Will made a mess or left his gear around, Granny'd bang drawers at him or clash the pots and pans. Well, when we got there, sure enough, there was a tea kettle whistling and the rocker going back and forth. Will gave me a funny look and said to the rocker, he said this, "Granny, this is my friend Greg. Now don't you play your tricks and frighten him now." And the rocker stopped. Stopped dead. And that was it for the weekend. No bumps in the night, no chill wind or rattling chains or anything. Until, right before I was to get the bus back, Will made us a last pot of coffee, poured the cups on the stove and started drinking his. I said, "Hey, where's mine?" And then I saw that other coffee cup lift itself up off the counter and sail slowly through the air to plop down right next to my hand.
That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to thank Annabelle, Katie, and Perry for their readings. Excellent job, my friends. We'll be back in a week with more. And until then...